Welcome to Crime Corner, where we examine all things crime, whether it be on the page, on the screen, on the street, or in the courtroom. I'm Matt Coyle, author of the Rick Cahill Crime Series, and I'll be your host for as long as it takes. The music was really loud in my ear today, but at least it was planned. My guest tonight, David Putnam, comes from a law enforcement family and always wanted to be a cop, which makes sense. During his career, he did it all. Worked in narcotics, served on FBI-sponsored violent crime teams, was sworn in as a U.S. Marshal, pursuing murder suspects and bank robbers in Arizona, Nevada, California. Dave did two tours on the San Bernardino County Sheriff's SWAT team. He also has experience in criminal intelligence and internal affairs and has supervised corrections, patrol, and a detective bureau. In Hawaii, Dave was a member of the real-life Hawaii Five-O, serving as a special agent for the Attorney General investigating smuggling and white-collar crimes. The Reckless, finally get to his books, is the sixth in the Bruno Johnson series and the second of the Young Bruno prequels. Dave lives in Southern California with his wife, Mary, and I believe still a brood of dogs. Welcome, David Putnam.
Thank you for having me. This is great.
No, it's not that good.
Yeah, it's good.
So tell the listeners a little bit about The Reckless, your sixth Bruno thriller.
Like you said, it's a prequel. It's the second prequel in a series of four. I wrote the first four Bruno books in the current day, and then in the fourth book, The Vanquished, I left him kind of emotionally and physically damaged and broken. And the publisher asked me how I was going to bring him back from that, and after I thought about it, she was probably right. So I decided to go with the prequels. And the prequels are basically the background that I set up in the first four books. And they are snapshots of Bruno Johnson's career. The first one, Innocence, is about him partially in a leaving a patrol assignment and going to a narcotics assignment. And then the second one, The Reckless, is after he's been an experienced detective and he goes and works for a violent crimes team where he is asked to join the FBI bank robbery team. And I took that from my real-life experiences when I was doing the same thing.
And how old is Bruno in this book?
That's a tough question. I think he's about 26, 27, maybe 28.
And you're going to do four. Are you basically, have you already finished the fourth? How fast do you write? Prequel.
Yeah, they picked up the third prequel, which is called The Heartless, and it comes out next February. And I'm just finishing the last prequel, which right now is being called The Ruthless, today. I just put the finishing touches on it today.
They being Ocean View. So after you get done with the fourth prequel, you're going to go, are you going to write a number nine Bruno in the, the modern times? Fifth Bruno, modern times, ninth of the series?
As long as they keep taking them, as long as Ocean View keeps taking them, I'm gonna write them. I have two more ideas for books in the current day, which will be right at the end of What Happened to the Vanquished.
Then you'll still have to get back to that question of how you're going to pull Bruno back from the abyss.
Yeah, I've got kind of an idea how to do that now. But I've had a four-year hiatus thinking about it.
Yeah, really. So I sometimes bemoan the fact that my first book had two word title, and I bitch and whine about that because every Ocean View wants every title to be two words, but you really only have one word. you have the, and then you have the Innocence,
yeah.
The Reckless, the
All right.
That's got to be tough.
Are all
the titles yours?
No.
Did you come up with every one, or someone's helping you?
The first book. Disposables was originally called The Other Side of Forever, and the publisher said, no, sounds too much like a romance. So
right.
they asked for additional titles, and I sent them five other ones, and they picked one, and they picked The Disposables, and that was fine with me.
And so then they said, hey, we really like that, the one word title, and then you're on, you come up with six of them.
Right.
That's pretty good. So Bruno, Where did Bruno come from? I don't believe you're African American. I knew you were a cop. Is he a combination of cops you worked with or knew, or is he a complete fabrication?
No, I take him. He's an amalgamation of different cops that I really liked working with and respected. It made me African American because I wanted an added layer of conflict. People read for emotion, and conflict is emotion. So that's basically the way I did it. The name is kind of funny because the way I came about the name, a friend of mine, I was over at his house, and it was actually his girlfriend's dog was named Bruno Johnson. And I liked the dog's name, so I just kind of used it for my book.
It's a great name. So I'm guessing Bruno Johnson was like a bulldog or something.
Oh, no, it was a little mutt terrier kind of thing.
Oh, that's even better.
Real scrappy and feisty. And that's what kind of like Bruno Johnson, the character.
So what about Bruno's dad? He's the voice of reason in all the books that I've read, which I think is all of them. So where did he come from?
Well, he's just the pillar in the community and somebody that Bruno looks up to and he tries to aspire to. So he's kind of an easy one to write because he's always on straight and narrow. You know, he's always black and white. And Bruno always knows where his dad is on any kind of topic, but he still asks him for advice.
Yeah, and he makes a lot of sacrifices for Bruno, too.
Right. Wait till you see this book, the one I just finished.
The one you just finished being number 4 and 8?
Yeah. It's a fourth.
Well,
prequel,
sort of,
it's number
sort of 8 and 4, yeah.
I
can't wait.
Yeah.
So I've noticed that there are strong women throughout the Bruno series. Talk a little bit about Special Agent Chelsea Miller, who is in The Reckless. Where did she come from?
Well, the publisher likes to have what they call romantic thrillers. So I throw a woman in, a woman interest in, to you know, keep things moving. And I don't know, but I've worked with a lot of female detectives, patrol officers, and I just, again, it's an amalgamation of a bunch of different people.
So you're saying if Pat at Ocean didn't say, hey, we really like to have some romance in here, you wouldn't have stuck her in there?
It depends. I need a secondary plot line, and that's a good way to divert the reader's attention while you give other information
right.
for a plot twist. I lost my train of thought on that one. Sorry.
It's all right.
Sorry, I got a cold.
It was an average question. Yeah, you sound like a little bit like you got a cold. You've been writing Bruno for a long time. But I don't think that you're a huge character arc guy. But when you first started writing, did you have an idea, well, this is where Bruno starts and then he's going to end up here? Or have you learned more about him with each book?
Oh, I definitely learned more about him with each book. And it's actually, these books are the funnest. Last four books have been the most enjoyable for me to write because it was already background pre-established. And this book I just finished is the final link. So I had all the different background stories that I had not completed that I had to put in. So it was kind of a really fun book to write because it was already there for me.
Right. Well, anyone who's read the Frontline Bruno books knows that, let's see, there's a whole lot of kids that have to come around and a new love interest. So, we don't really need to get into when you tackle that, but obviously that's something you're going to have to tackle, or you already did.
Right. Yeah, there's some interesting twists in the book I just finished. It kind of interested me is that I didn't know what was going to happen until the end. I don't know what's going to happen when I start writing the book, usually. But this one, I had set things that I had to do.
Right.
But I didn't know how the book was going to end.
That's interesting you should say that because I know from talking with you that you really pull all your books come from something that happened to you as a police officer. So you would think that, of course, you have to fictionalize to some degree. You would think that you would know what the end is because you lived it.
Yeah. Well, that's true to some degree. I pick an emotional event that I was involved in, and I write it as best I can and put as much conflict in it, and then I write the book on both ends of that scene. But that doesn't mean I know how the book's going to end. The scene creates the conflict, and I just go with it.
We don't need to get too deep into this, but I'm speaking of emotion and real events. I know this book was in some way spurred by something very emotional that happened to you. We don't have to get into it. I don't want to give anything away. But was this a very – I know you probably wrote this book about 2 years ago. But was this a difficult book to write emotionally because you were dealing with some real stuff in your background?
Yeah, that book was emotionally was the most difficult book for me to write. And it was interesting because I tried to write and sell books for many years, and I was on my 38th manuscript when I sold the 34th one. But I shifted to a thriller structure when I sold the book. And so with this book, The Reckless, I wanted to get a lot, build up a lot more emotion in the book and show exactly what happened with the person that you're talking about in the book. And so I wrote it on a mystery structure. And I turned the book in, and the publisher said they loved the book, but they wanted me to cut the first 100 pages because that's where the thriller structure actually started. And I had to cut all the motivation for the emotion in the latter part of the book. So I had to cut the first 100 pages, and I had to add 100 pages on the back end. It ended up being a great thriller, I think, because of that. But I think I gave up a lot of emotion over it, too.
That's interesting a way of looking at it. That's a very honest thing to say. But you do pack emotion in there, and you said you just maybe just put some of it in a different spot.
Right. Yeah.
You touched on – go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. I touched on
No. I'm asking you the questions. I'm just the middleman.
Yeah, the Reckless, each book as I went along, especially in the prequels, they became more and more real. So the Innocence, about 50% of that book, it actually happened. And then the Reckless, about 80% of that book, I wrote some of the scenes just the way they went down.
Well, there's some really – that makes it even more harrowing because there's some really exciting stuff. I mean, nobody writes cop action as well as you out there right now as far as I read.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. So you kind of segued into what was going to be my next question, and I want you to expound a little bit on it because we have a lot of listeners who are writers in various stages of their careers or maybe not yet quite careers. So talk a little bit more about the 38 books or the – tell us, first of all, because I think this is – I know you've told it before, but we have new listeners – about, like, why you said, hey, I can do this. I can write mystery novels.
Oh. I mean the genesis of it.
Right. I don't know those big words, but I think it might be.
Well, I was always an avid reader. I read everything. And when I was working narcotics, I kept novels in the back seat of my undercover car. And anytime I had downtime, I would read a book. And
tell them why you might have downtime and why a lot of us get the surveillance stuff wrong.
Because it's not like on television or in the movies. Or even a lot of books. When you have a surveillance, you need to have four or five guys at least on one target, and not all of them are in view of the target. They're laid off someplace, and only one guy has the eye. And so when one guy, you rotate the eye every 3 or 4 hours so because of the fatigue factor, and then everybody else sits in their car waiting for movement. So there was a lot of time that I got to read novels. It was great. I get paid to read books, and I kept novels in the back seat of my car. And one day I was out in the middle of Mojave Desert. It was the CERN Valley, and it was a meth lab surveillance, and I was down to my last book. But It was the sophomore effort of this guy who wrote a national bestseller, and I loved the first book, and I thought, this is going to be a great book. And I started reading it, and it was terrible. I could not believe how bad it was. But I was a captive audience, so I read the whole thing. And when I finished it, I thought, I could do better than that. And I started writing my first four novels on the front seat of my undercover car. And each novel was four legal pads long. But I quickly learned that a good author makes it look easy, and it took me a long time to perfect the craft.
All right, before we delve more into that, I'm not going to ask you who the guy was, but is he still writing novels?
Yes, he is. And I think what happens in many, what happened in this case, what happens, I think, a lot, is that an author will work on one novel for 10 or 15 years and finally get it perfected, and then it's picked up, and he only has 1 year to write the next one. So
right.
He hasn't really perfected his craft. But this guy, his next novel, he actually improved his craft because the editors, you know, he turned a book in, his editors were helping him learn the craft. So his books got better and better, and he's still writing today.
And he's on still a stardom trajectory?
He did it for a while, but now he's back up doing pretty well.
Cool. I'll start throwing some names out there. You can just tell me yes or no. Just kidding. So you probably didn't know anything about writing books. You knew you could write one better than the one you'd read. But when did you figure out, hey, I got to get an agent or all that stuff?
Well, I had four agents. Like I said, I started writing in 1989 or 90. And so, you know, I didn't sell the first book until 2013. So I was writing
wow.
a long time. So, you know, different agents. I think I was at 156 rejections before I stopped counting. I had a three-ring binder, and I was putting them in the – I was keeping them all. And actually, I think it was two of the huge black three-ring binders. And I was keeping all the rejection letters. And as rejection letters go, people think it's funny, but, you know, I would get on a manuscript, I get red ink, no thanks on it. And then toward the end, I was getting one full page rejections or two full page
right.
rejections, telling me how much they like the
right.
book. I made it two acquisitions twice, which means the editor liked it and took it to try to get the slot, and they got beat out by another editor. So I got close a couple of times before I finally sold one.
And that is the process. When you mentioned your three-ring binders, I thought, well, you've got your own murder books.
Right.
So now, famous author, you lead a writer's group in your hometown of, I won't say where, because you don't have it on your bio and your web address.
It's Temecula. It's Temecula.
Okay.
You
can keep it. I thought maybe you were hiding out like Bruno.
No.
How important do you think it is for, because you're in this group, you've been leading it for a while, and you've been in other writers' groups, how important is it for writers to get feedback from other writers before they send their manuscript to a potential agent, their agent, or publishers?
Well, there's different, you know, there's varying degrees. You know, what you have to avoid in a writer's group is writing by committee. You know, people, the author has to have enough ego or confidence to say, no, I don't like that idea, and so to me, in a read and critique group, you should be critiquing the craft, and if there's a clunker for motivation, reaction, then bring it up. But the read and critique group should not be plot driven or story driven, and the writer should do that. Otherwise, it becomes writing a book by committee, and that book can get real jumbled that way. So I think it's critical, but there's some reservations with it too. I think beta readers are very, very critical, and a beta reader should not be a writer. A beta reader should be somebody who reads within the genre that you're writing.
Why should it not be a writer?
Because writers look at it. I read books now and I put them down because I don't like them. Because of the craft, it's like fingernails on a chalkboard. A fan is who you're writing to begin with. So why wouldn't you use a test market of the people that you're trying to entice?
True.
You see
Although,
what
I see what you mean, but most writers, well, are fans first, but you're right, it is hard to separate. You were a cop for many years, as we learned, and you've been retired for, what, 8 or 10 years, somewhere around there? 7, 8 years?
I retired in 2011.
Okay, so 8 years, almost, probably. How has your writing schedule changed since you were a cop? Because obviously we know you were writing when you were working, when you literally weren't working.
Well, I did most of my writing. I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I write for 3 hours before I went to work. And that's when I did the majority of my work. So I still have that. I still get up early, not as early. But sometimes I get up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and sometimes I get up at 5 o'clock. But I get my writing done first before I do anything else.
Mm-hmm. So what about the actual process?
Well,
you don't really
up,
don't outline, really, do you?
No, I don't outline. No, I don't outline. I get up in the morning, and I go back 20 pages. And it's because I want the language, the syntax, and the cadence to be all the same. Because I realize that I sit down sometimes and I might be a little bit depressed or I might be a little bit elated. You don't want that to come through in your writing. You want it to be smooth. So I go back and I start reading forward, 20 pages back, read forward, editing as I go. And then I start the new stuff and I go 4 pages forward. So I'm always circling back. I circle back on everything 4 or 5 times before I move forward. And I follow a strict format and structure. You know, there's four C's of writing, of structure: conflict, complication, crisis, conclusion. The 5 things a scene needs. So if I don't really have writer's block, because I just, if something happens and I say what's going on, I stop and reexamine where I am, and I said, oh, right there, I forgot the one of the 5 things in this scene needs, and then I put that in there, and it automatically takes me forward.
I haven't been taking calls for a while, but somebody actually called in, so I'm going to answer this call and see what they want.
All right.
Hello, Eric Killed 559. Who's this?
Hi, this is Terrell Bird. I still remember when you guys came down and talked to Sisters in Crime.
That's right, up
and
in Fresno.
And we had it was a great talk. Yes, Fresno area. And I've been out of the loop for a while because I think I've only read 3 of Dave's books. Looks like I'm going to have to get back in the loop and catch up with him. But it's been interesting talk. I'm always interested in people's stories of how they got started and how they go about writing their books and all that good stuff. And I don't think I'll live long enough to go through 156 rejection letters, but I might have to when I get to that point.
Well,
I'm hoping to get a few less than that.
Send out more queries at a time.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I think I have somebody at a publishing company that wants to read it. I just have to try to push to get enough for him to look it over. I'm still trying to do the first major rewrite at this point, so I just have to kind of push through it. And
good luck with that.
It's interesting. Yeah, it was interesting too that you said you had to throw out the first 100 and put in the second 100 because I'm about 10,000 words short. Because it has to be longer, but I'll get there. I know I will. But it's good to hear. It's good to hear from both of you, and it's good to hear from you, Matt, too, that you've got your program back up and running. And it's always great to hear everybody's stories. Now, are you going to talk about Hawaii 5-0? You know, we all want to hear that.
I just realized
you know that's why, you know that's why I called in, right?
Well, you've heard the story then.
Actually, though, Dave, I did want to tell you, the other day something came up on some show on TV, and it flashed through my head how you mentioned that in your early days of police work, the level of care that's taken on the forensics and not spoiling the crime scenes was completely different than what they show in pictures now. And I was looking at something then some years ago, and I thought, well, possibly in that period that was kind of the way they handled the case because somebody was really thinking, but they're walking through everything and they're not taking bags and they're not doing this and that. And I said, well, in the period, that might not have happened. And so I thought, Dave Putman was the one that said that when he was at a talk one time.
Well,
so,
Terrell,
I'll let you guys go and finish here.
But let me tell you, if you want to catch up to Dave, if you want to catch up on Dave's work, you better hurry up because he writes them about as fast as you read them. So you got to get after it.
I know he does. He cranks those puppies out. I know. Yeah, I am finally gainfully employed again. So I actually have money to go purchase some books now occasionally, and so I'm going to start catching up with everybody.
Good deal.
Great.
And getting back on track.
Thanks for the support.
Thank you very much.
You bet.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
Hey, now we're getting a lot of listener feedback because while we were speaking with Terrell, Elena sent me an instant message saying you were mentioning the five things necessary in a scene, and she didn't hear that. So you better come up.
Okay. There's they're kind of general, but there's point of view, there's forward the story, there's display character, there's foreshadowing upcoming event.
Oh my God! Yeah, wait a second. And, you have a critique partner.
What?
I heard her. Go ahead.
And then the fifth one is setting up your transition. But at the same time, not leaving any emotion on the table. So sometimes authors will not realize that they have some setups that they're walking away from. So I make sure that I flesh those out and I carry them forward. So it's the foreshadow upcoming event, move the story, display character. Also, the big thing that I think I like in writing and what I do is I don't try to write the story. I try to write the scene the best way to display the character, not the best way to display the story. So that really changes my thinking around, and it helps me with the five things. So when I come at a scene, I don't come at it as a story. I come at it as the best way to display my character.
But you're also taking into consideration your characters, what they want in the scene, right?
Yes, that's motivation. That's part of MAR, motivation, action, reaction, and that's another thing that I pay attention to within the scene.
Right. I don't have it. No one else wants to talk to us anymore. But so what is next? We know you're like five books ahead, but
no, I'm not that far ahead. The book is done. The Heartless is done for next February, and the book finished now to turn in next February. So I'm going to write. I got a couple of things I'm working on. I've got another standalone series that's finished. I'm polishing that up, and I've got a couple of other standalones I want to try to get to.
A standalone series? I don't know how that works.
Well, I mean, what I mean,
you mean a series of standalones?
Other than Bruno. Sorry, I misspoke. It's not a standalone. It's a separate series from Bruno.
Cool.
And it's the first book, so it's a standalone until they pick up the series. And then I have additional books in mind for that standalone if somebody picks it up. That's what I meant.
It's fantastic. Someone told me, well, let me ask you a question. Are you collaborating with anybody on something? Anything?
Yeah. I think I told you that. In fact, I talked to you about doing it, too. This one particular high concept that I had, I think it's a great idea. I couldn't get the – I tried to write it twice, and I could not get the female point of view right. So there was a woman in that group who was a very successful writer. I asked her if she wanted to take my – I wrote the whole book all the way through, and now she took it, and she is taking the male voice out of my female FBI agent. She's regendering my character.
Regendering.
And it's coming out really great. I think the book's going to – I think it has a good chance.
Do you – you don't want to give her name.
Oh, Judy Bernstein. She is the author of They Poured Fire on Us from the Sky, sold 200,000 copies, and she just had another book come out called Disturbing Her Nests.
Let me see. I just got – before we go – there's other people calling you with questions, irritating. This one particularly irritating because of who she is. Maddie wants to know what makes Bruno. I don't want people calling in with questions or sending questions that are better than I already had, so I don't think I'm going to even say it. What makes Bruno different from other cops on paper? currently on paper means? What makes him different?
Well, I think, I'm the author, so it's kind of hard. I think to me, is a real-life person. You know, I try to write him that way. I sensationalize some events for entertainment's sake, but I think what Bruno says, his dialogue, the way he acts, I think he's true to his character. I think that's why I think he looks good on paper.
Well, there you go, Maddie, who does...
Thanks, Maddie. Thanks, Maddie.
No, Maddie's great with her thing in Orange County, which is lit up Orange County. Yeah, it's great. A lot of fun. She asks hard questions, but usually they're not. Well, they're directed at us sometimes. Okay, well, you gave us what's next. A lot of books. Well, we'll wait for your collaboration. That seems that's exciting. But in the meantime, we know we won't see you at conferences because you're not doing them this year.
Right, I'm taking a break. I hate the conferences for 5 years straight. I'm taking a break this year. Just going to write.
Right. Well, congrats on your success. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And I will talk to you when the next one comes. I'll talk to you before that, but we'll have you on when the next one comes out.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks, buddy.
Okay, bye.
Let's see. In a couple weeks, I'm going to have Glenn Eric Hamilton on with his new book, and I don't have it in front of me. I have the book. I think it's called Mercy River. I apologize if I didn't get it right, but we all know Glenn's a great writer, so looking forward to that. And just want to let you know, if you have a book club out there and you want me to yak at it, you can contact me via my website, and there's a link on my website called Novel Network, which is kind of a new book club feature, or you can contact me directly. My email address is mattcoylebooks@gmail.com. So we'll see you in a couple of weeks. This is a copyrighted, trademarked podcast owned solely by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.